All right. Paper 114. I think that's right. Paper 114. Section 6. Which is old single column, page 1254. All right. Well, this is a most intriguing section in many ways, and I do really want to just do this section tonight. I want us to really, you know, spend some time talking about some of these things. You have a number of little, you know, sort of bullet points here, these 12 groups of angels, those of you who are familiar with the paper, that sort of just blow by in quick fashion if you just read it. But the ramifications of all of them is just huge. We really, you know, should spend some time seeing if we can take our relationship to this section up a notch, because it's definitely a section that leaves more questions dangling than it answers, you know, by far. So I think they really, really want us to spend some time getting our juices flowing, you know, on it, thinking about what it really means to have a paper with this title, you know, to actually, you know, recognize that there's a planetary government, you know, and that that's not some, well, that's on the spirit plane or something, and that has no consequence to me. You know, there is no spirit plane, you know. All beings in the universe are domiciled on material abodes. You know, the entire universe is very direct and literal, just like we think it is. You know, just because our limited vision can't see beings doesn't mean that isn't so. And so it's a, you know, it's a quite intriguing section. Someone maybe can think about, you know, taking the reading here. And I'll let me just read that last little tiny paragraph of the previous section while someone's queuing up here, and yeah, because they're transitioning into this section. So let's kind of get ourselves in the flow again. So remember, they were giving us in that previous section just a nice little overview of this planetary government that they had pretty much laid out the main points of in the previous sections. And then they say that the direct administrative cabinet of the Governor General consists of 12 seraphim, the acting chiefs of the 12 groups of special angels functioning as the immediate superhuman directors of planetary progress and stability. Now, on that, the play between those two, you'll see, is a key element of these groups of angels, that play between progress and stability. So who would like to read for us here? All that
I will, I guess.
I wouldn't mind reading, but if somebody...
All right.
You're administrative.
Yeah.
Six, the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision. When the first Governor General arrived on Urantia, concurrent with the outpouring of the Spirit of Truth, he was accompanied by 12 corps of special seraphim.
Corps.
Seraphington graduates who were immediately assigned to certain special planetary services. These exalted angels are known as the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision and are, aside from the over-control of the Planetary Most High Observer, under the immediate direction of the Resident Governor General.
Okay, so just remember the who we're talking about here. If you don't remember, if you go back to the papers about the seraphim, those seraphim that make it all the way to the center of all things for whatever reason, and actually go through those schools on Seraphington, those special schools, they can become part of a core of seraphim working throughout the universes, doing jobs like this. They're called the core of seraphic completion, or the seraphic core of completion. And just when referring to them, you'll at various places in the book, you'll see them, talking about seraphim of completion or completion seraphim. Okay, that's who we're talking about. We're talking about seraphim who have gone through enough and varied evolutionary experience in the universe of universes that they've brought themselves up to the kind of level that for instance, the high angel that's writing this paper, primary supernafim, they're up there functioning, at that level in the universe, doing these jobs that require full integrity. A seraphim of completion is never going to rebel. And so we've got a core of these seraphim always accompany a planetary prince on any planet. So there would have been some core. We don't know exactly how many or what the structure was, because they don't elaborate. There would have been a core way back when, but then that all got upset. They're not some sort of a self-governing group or whatever. As you can see, they're pointing out here, they're under the resident governor general and the Most High Observer. And then, of course, there's the chief of seraphim, the supernafim, that's writing the paper. So they have, they're definitely leading the government, but they are a huge part in our very special planetary government. We have 12 of these cores. Who knows? Maybe some of them were ones that were there 500,000 years ago. We don't know. As you may remember, or you'll see as we get into it, out of these 12 groups, some of them have been here for 2,000 years. Others have, there's been many groups that have cycled through under that title. But be it as it may, you have the cream of the crop of the seraphim, master seraphim. And the parallel wording there is purposeful. Master Son, Master Seraphim. In other words, they've achieved that level of really connection to the whole of the grand universe. Not obviously at the level of a Master Son, but they are functioning in that role of the integrous celestial beings that really function throughout the universe of universes. Make sure that it all is held together in spite of the vicissitudes that can occur down in the lower levels of things.
Just a quick question. Mm-hmm. This group of seraphim, mm-hmm. They're all trained on Seraphington.
Right.
They got one hell of a journey to get here.
Right, yeah.
So they had to have been picked
Right, they tell you that, because Nebadon is not that old of a local universe, we haven't had tons of seraphim that have made it there. But there definitely are quite a few.
What kind of time is it for these beings?
Well, just like you and I. Just like the Finaliters that are here. That it's a long, 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 long journey there and back. 200. To Uversa, it's 200,000 light years. Even at three times the speed of light, that's a long journey. Let alone taking the journey into the center of all things and back again.
We're talking decades, at least.
Well, we're talking a lot more. Very, very long time. 200,000 divided by 3 is still pretty close to numbers with lots of digits. That's one way. That's only from here to Uversa. It has nothing to do about getting to the other side of the super universe. We're talking about very, very just pure travel time, let alone all, they're ascending. that whole time. You know, they're not just traveling there, going to school and coming back. You know, these are angels that have gone through a whole long journey. You know, some of those angels that you know, make it all the way in there and go through Seraphington, you know, become part of the core finality, and, you know, and some of them, you know, I mean, there's all these things they do, but, you know, they've gone all the way there, you know, so, yeah, beings with vast amounts of experience.
Do we know they're from Nebadon?
Let me think. Can't remember if they tell us point blank on that or not. Let me look here.
Nebadon, the universe.
Let's see. Did they say for sure? even you,
Our universe.
No, it doesn't say definitively.
So they could be from
but,
an older.
But it's kind of implied, because it's in the context, you know, of telling you that Nebadon is, comparatively speaking, one of the younger universes, and therefore does not have so many of these returned Seraphington graduates. You know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and then they end that paragraph with this. So, you know, I think it's implied.
Yeah,
and,
I would agree.
Yeah, I could ruminate on that a little bit, but it's probably.
Yeah, why would we have seraphim from some other local universe coming? You know.
Yeah, I mean,
just as well have any other kind of being.
Yeah.
Seraphim would imply that it's important to have the experience of having been here.
Yeah.
Served here.
I mean, the only thing that, you know, that might bring some question, you know, at the times when they tell you there's people from Avalon, you know, here, and you're going, why is that, you know, but I think probably, yeah.
And here it mentions again in passing, aside from the over-control of the planetary Most High Observer, so you've mentioned that quite a lot, the over-control of the Most Highs, but yeah. Can we... Does that imply the control of the seraphim?
Well, definitely when he assumes regency. But, you know, you'll see as we read into this, you know, they mention at points, you know.
In other words, over control of the Most Highs, but controlled by the seraphim, Master Seraphim, possibly. I don't know.
Well, you know, you'll see how that plays out as we read right. In. But there are definitely, you know, some of these that the Most High Observer works with more closely than others. Because it's more of the seraphim, yeah. Because they're more related to his jobs as opposed to the, you know, the jobs that the governor general has.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, yeah. So again, just so you recognize who we're talking about. Masters of, you know, an appropriate word here. We're talking high integrity, high long experienced beings.
These 12 groups of angels, while functioning under the general supervision of the resident governor general, are immediately directed by the Seraphic Council of 12, the acting chiefs of each group. This council also serves as the volunteer cabinet of the resident governor general. As planetary chief of Seraphim, I preside over this council of Seraphic chiefs, and I am a volunteer supernophim of the primary order, serving on Urantia as a successor of the one-time chief of the angelic hosts of the planet who defaulted at the time of the Caligastia secession.
See, so just, you know, he's mentioning all that because the two are obviously correlated. When things go horribly wrong, you know, who comes in are those that are of unquestioned integrity that take the reins. You know, he took the reins of chief of the seraphim, and you know, these master seraphim came in to really take control of all of that, all those assistants and aids that you need to coordinate everything.
Well, apparently the seraphim that he replaced, or the
no seraphim, it would have been a seraphim to you,
but obviously not a graduate of a seraphim.
No.
Okay.
That was also from the president.
No, we don't know who that.
It's Bob.
Thank you, John. Information.
Don's good for that kind of thing.
Chris?
Yeah.
Yeah, it says here that he's a voluntary supernophim, but the author of this paper is called chief of Seraphim.
Yeah, who is a voluntary Supernovim. This person is writing, yeah, is talking there. Okay. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Confusing.
Right, it's getting, right, it's just, I mean, like I was just saying, I mean, normally you would have a Seraphim as chief of Seraphim on a planet. But if that chief, you know, joins a rebellion, then in those circumstances, if you go back and read the primary Supernovim, it tells you, I think it's on the first page of that one, it tells you that these primary Supernovim always step in and take over under those circumstances. So he did that 200,000 years ago.
Do we know who asked him to do that?
I'm not sure. Let's go back and look. I can't remember if that's alluded to or not.
The 12th Corps of Masters of the Master Seraphim of Planetary Supervision are functional on Urantia as follows.
Okay, so we launch into each of these, and we'll pause after each one, and we'll spend some time talking about what do we think that and what that implies. You know, so as he reads each of them, you know, have that in mind, thinking about, okay, so this is what they basically are there for. Now what? What are the consequences of that? And then we'll talk about it.
One, the epical angels. These are the angels of the current age, the dispensational group. These celestial ministers are entrusted with the oversight and direction of the affairs of each generation as they are designed to fit into the mosaic of the age in which they occur. The present corps of epical angels serving on Urantia is the third group assigned to the planet during the current dispensation.
Okay, so just that little snippet, see? But, you know, think about it. What does that imply? Okay, the first thing, you know, it's interesting that they're putting this group first in the list, that there is a group of angels that are very now-focused. You know, notice that I made a point. It's not just, you know, this dispensation sort of really kind of, you know, keeping an eye on, you know, it's literally each generation. So there's a group of angels, you know, and all the helpers they would have and whatnot, that are specifically devoted to thinking about each generation and what role they play in the big picture. You know, think about how different that idea is than, you know, each generation bemoaning the next generation as, you know, as being clueless to, you know, I mean, this the whole sense that we have of generational transference, you know, going all the way back to the ancient Greeks, you know, bemoaning it. There's this very intimately engaged group of angels that are, you know, fostering my generation, your generation, et cetera, you know, to play a certain part in a big picture. For instance, for you to have a sense that somehow you are the big picture, you know, you and this and a given generation, they're actually going to be, you know, working against that. You know, it's like, no, you're getting outside of, you know, you're just this little part of the big picture. You know, you're not doing the next generation. You're not doing the previous generation. You're doing just your little generation, that brief little time that you're here, and you're going to do it well. And if you try to get out of that, we're actually going to conspire against you, okay, and thwart your efforts to function outside of your generation. You know, let alone, of course, outside of the big picture.
Yes. If you take 2,000 years divided by 3, the number is 666.
You just can hardly wait to get going on that part of it, huh?
Oh boy.
I was
excited about that.
Oh boy.
0.67. Yeah, it's not quite, you know. Right, depends on how far you. Yeah. But 2 divided by 3 is 2/3, which is. Yeah.
You're making my old stitches hurt. You're laughing so hard. I'm all healed.
We'll get to that stuff in a little bit. So what are some thoughts? So what things jump, you know, come to mind? What do you think of in that regard? I mean, how would that work? What would they be, you know, what would be their main modus operandi, you know, to be fostering that?
How do they divide up generations? Because people are being born in
all the time.
Where do you demark when one generation starts and another one leaves off?
Yeah, that's a good question. What do people think? Is there...
Well, there's, you know, you talk to readers that have been around a long time, especially from the baby boom years, and they say, you know, the 60s have had a great influence on, you know, and they even wrote songs in the 60s about my generation, you know, talking about my generation, you know, and it was a very, you know, it was a... What's that?
What's the relevance?
Well, the relevancy is, I think
there's
what he's talking
social,
about.
You know, most likely what we're talking about is social generations.
Yeah.
You know, not, you know, literal biologic generations.
The answer's blown in the wind.
Yeah. How many times?
Yeah, but I think that's what he's talking about.
What
do you think it is, Chris?
No, I mean.
Is that the angels of the 60s that hit something?
Right, and see, that's kind of what we're leaning. See,
they were talking about love, and well, ask Steve. Steve can tell it better than I can, right, Steve?
Yeah. I mean, I agree completely. Is that not seemingly what they're, you know, pointing out that they're sort of an angels of the 60s? You know, an angel. See,
you know, getting together. We all got to
get one here first.
Brotherhood.
It seems like it must be kind of like how they demark races. It's got to be a mindset, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, you can kind of see groups of people with a similar mindset in a generational.
Yeah, and in that mindset, the set part. You notice how set, you know, your parents seem to be in their generation, say, or something like that. And and that's why I said what I said at the beginning. You know, notice that, you know, it appears that there's a whole group of angels and all their helpers that are really fostering that, you know, for them to be, you know, they play a scaffolding role. That generation plays a scaffolding role, you know, and it has to be that rung of the scaffolding, not the next rung, not the previous rung. You know? And so, you know, it's just interesting to think that there'd be someone kind of pulling back on the reins of them progressing too far, you know, in one generation.
Wouldn't it really be about getting them to go through what they have to go through and learn instead of just being held back? I mean, it's about progress.
Well, yeah, but that's the next group of angels. That's the next group of angels.
It's also about them fulfilling what it is that they're purposed to do.
Right.
And that's
time
what the next step is.
Right.
Where it is they're supposed to go.
Right. It's definitely not about staying put. It's about being part of a progress.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, that's what they mean by mosaic. That, and in the whole, because people go on the average, they're going to follow that and go there. And they make sure that...
Mm-hmm. You see, the thing that strikes me, the fact that this precedes the progress angels. It's a lot like when we talked about the difference between fact and truth. And before they tell you about the thing that's really, you know, fostering the flow, like the truth, they remind you that you have to, that truth flows through fact points.
Right.
And so there's a group of angels that make sure that there are fact points through which progress can flow. If we all just, you know, let go of being anchored in each generation, the progress has nothing to flow through. You know, it all just washes away in chaos.
It's also part of the genetics. It's already there are things that are programmed into the genetics
that
we don't know about that come up generation.
Right. And
there's
a progress in the mind, which has a lot to do.
Right.
You know, all these things are,
thing, and I'm not sure whether you will attribute this to the epical angels or the angels of progress.
Uh-huh.
In my lifetime, when I think about
how my parents' generation looked at things. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my years, we've had the civil rights, not revolution,
movement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've had the women's movement, mm-hmm. where women now are considered to be more equal with men and should be treated with respect and should be paid equally. Oh, we aren't there yet. Mm-hmm. And then we've also had, what was the third one I was thinking of? Well, the sexual revolution. Mm-hmm. People
sure.
think
right.
in different terms. Mm-hmm. I mean, my parents' generation would not have thought of unmarried people living together.
Right.
Now it's commonplace.
Right. There's a whole bunch of things. Yeah.
Big changes.
Right. Very big changes. Yeah.
Especially on cable. Vivid color.
Yeah,
HD, no less.
Chris, we're on our fifth epic, but they're on their third.
Oh, remember, and all this is happening since, 2,000 years ago, since Pentecost. Since Pentecost, like they're saying, there's been it's changed that many times. See, because they say during the current dispensation. So again, by epical they mean this epic. Angels of this epic, but the fact that they're not just of this epic, but literally of this generation, see, is the fascinating part of it.
One thing I'm wondering is. There's the idea of an age.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that a designated amount of time, or is it a designated amount of progress? Mm-hmm.
If you think about how
or both.
Yeah, well, again, Shane probably knows exactly what I'm going to say here because he just alluded to it a minute ago. I mean, that the real thing to keep in mind when they use terms like age, epic, era, the primary phenomenon that is progressing is mind. When it's the age of fishes, or the age of frogs, it's not about the molecular structure as much as it is about the mind that requires that molecular structure. The mind is progressing and the molecular structures are keeping up with that, just like your mind will progress. And they'll constantly retool your Marantia body to keep up with that. Okay. Now, it's top down, mind over matter. So the mind is what's truly progressing. The mind is what has ages. The fourth adjutant, had an age that dawned. The fifth adjutant had an age that dawned. The sixth adjutant had an age that dawned. So a lot of this, like that Jonas is pointing out, the very fact that the God, the Mother, not only the Supreme, but locally, as it's expressed in the local universe Mother, who is bestowing mind, upholding mind, those are evolutionary deity. Their mind is evolving, that mind that they're circuiting into us. So the mind that is encircuited into me is vastly different than the mind that was encircuited in someone 1,000 years ago, because the local universe Mother Spirit has evolved over that period of time. You can't go back to that old mind. That mind does not exist anymore. It's evolved forward. And so, obviously a lot of times these angels aren't necessarily causing these things, higher things are behind them, and they're fostering them. But then there's always that question of how intimate, do they get? Angel tweaking can be, kind of remote. We all know it can get a little bit more intimate at times. And so each one of these, that's always in play, that question of, when are they really kind of just fostering, and when occasionally might this group of angels really jump in directly? Because remember, we're not going to cover it tonight, but next week we're going to talk about the reservists, the destiny reservists. Every one of these 12 groups of angels has a group of reservists. So if the epical angels want to get really in play on something, they've got a group of reservists they can activate. to really jump into a generation. Do something very direct. What? I don't know.
I agree with what Joan is saying, and I know I've seen this, experienced it, lived it, about especially racial. We seem to have gotten better about that, but there are still some sections of the country that are still not everywhere.
Wait a minute. News flash. Seventh segment of Grand Universe, not yet perfect. the question is not how many things are not perfect yet. You know, what exactly are they engaging? Are these angels engaging a situation that is not yet perfect? Is that how they look at it? And again, Claire was pointing out, they're fundamentally seeing it as a dynamic phenomenon. The question is, what things are moving? God can't steer a parked car, and he doesn't try. Neither do the angels. If there's people whose cars are parked, they're going to get ignored. there's not much you can do. I mean, if they choose to be parked, they're parked. But those who choose to actually be in motion, if that has some very definitive relevance to how this generation fits into the bigger picture, then these angels step in. If it has something fundamental to do with progress itself, then the next group of angels jump in. To very much think of these angels in that dynamic setting. We're trying, the fifth epical revelation is really trying to challenge us to see our universe not only as vastly more complex than we ever imagined, but fundamentally dynamic. This generation is good if it's perfecting it in any measure, no matter how tiny. If it's perfecting, if it's moving, it's good. And God works with all that is good, like these epical angels, for instance. If it's not perfecting, then it's not real. And, it's a little consequence. To never again think of the universe as a dichotomy between perfect and imperfect. There's probably few things that the fifth epical revelation is trying to break us of more strongly than that, and to interpret the revelation in that old mode is so false, so wrong. I mean, by definition, you're just utterly distorting the truth of the revelation if you see anything in that mode, where. It's some battle between imperfect and perfect. Imperfect super universe level, versus perfect Havona level, or something like that. That is just so false. Because that which is imperfect is not real. So how could there be a real contest there?
That's why the group's name is Perfecting Horizons.
Right. It's perfecting. It's the contrast between perfecting and perfect. And all of the super additive consequences that brings into play, because they're both good. Good added to good yields a good that is impossible to achieve anywhere else. And if you can get something that's as remotely removed from the perfection of Havona as possible, and yet still able to move towards perfection, and you can bring that tiny, faint flicker of perfectingness, into play with perfect, you've got the greatest super additive potential, realized possible in the I am. In the finiteness that was the I am. And so actually, the greatest discovery in the universe for those who are guiding it is to find that faintest flicker. That's not a parked car. That's the pearl of great price. That's the truth of that passage. I mean, that there's, I mean, finding something that's, you know, that's already there in light and life, well, okay, yeah. But the pearl of great price is that which is, you know, and an infanta level, but moving, you know. You take something not that far from that level, his name was Amadon. You know, was that not a pearl of great price? See, when perfection and perfecting this came together, you know, and it transformed the whole grand universe. One little faint flicker of faith. Yeah.
Hey, Chris,
all right.
Yeah. This will qualify as the second dumbest question I've asked in this class.
Is this a personal series of yours?
It's a, but it's
a commitment.
Next week will be the third dumbest.
All right.
Not this first dumbest. But this caught me that the Supernatum was a volunteer.
Right.
And then I read on the sacred spheres of paradise, on the worlds of the infinite spirit, this following comment: to me, the executive worlds are the most interesting and intriguing spots outside of paradise. In no other place in the wide universe can one observe such varied activities involving so many different orders of living beings, having to do with the operations on so many diverse levels, occupations at once material, intellectual, and spiritual. Well, I am accorded a period of release from assignment if I chance to be on paradise or in Nirvana. I usually proceed to one of these busy worlds of the seven master spirits, there to inspire my mind with spectacles of enterprise, devotion, loyalty, wisdom, and effectiveness. Mm-hmm. So knowing that seraphim are from the infinite spirit, and the supernaphim are, and this one volunteered, and then having read that at this world, that they are intrigued by such things as enterprise, devotion, effectiveness, it made me wonder, are these seraphim paid? If one volunteers...
They are paid. How are they paid?
Let me just finish for one second. If one volunteers, is there an economy of the universe of effectiveness, of enterprise, of wisdom, and wouldn't it stand to reason that angels and ascended beings like us, when we get to the mansion worlds, we'll have real jobs, we'll have to eat, we'll have to have a place to live, there's got to be some enterprise, as they just described here.
What is the enterprise?
In the universe.
What is the grand, and I use the, you know, the word purposely, in the grand universe, what is the grand enterprise? It's a perfect, we were just talking about it. It's an evolutionary domain. Everyone knows that that's the whole point, is to evolve. They eagerly are seeking to volunteer. You know, I would love to be put in a situation that'll challenge me to evolve in a ways that I've never been challenged before. Please, 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 please. You know, so 50 hands go up, but only one can go. You know, only one gets picked. But they all are just, you know, falling all over each other trying to volunteer because it's like, oh, that sounds really, really hard. I can hardly wait. Because I am going to evolve like you've never seen a supernaphim evolve when I go there.
So, Chris, it seems like it would make sense that there's some economy that deals with them coming to a planet. They probably got time and a half for your ranch. But wouldn't it make sense that seraphim, because they're not, I mean, they're much higher than we are, but they're not in the grand scheme of things.
They're it's literally paid.
Michael,
think of them, they're literally paid organically. They evolve. They are more brilliant. Mm-hmm. They glow with more brilliance afterwards than they did before. You know, they glow with, you know, with more brilliance than any pile of gold that they could have been paid with. They're paid in something real, something eternal.
Experience.
And irreplaceable, you know, in all eternity. That experience. That they didn't just ingest, but digested.
Transformed.
And made part of their form. You know, just like you are, your experiences when you're a finaliter, so are all, you know, so are all the other evolutionary beings. They literally grow like you and I. They're paid in substance of reality, of form. All right, let's go to the progress angels, since we already kind of wanting to roll over into them, see what they say. Oh, wait, before I do that, just a total aside, since Mo alluded to his question last week, just a little asterisk on the side here. It is the case that, just like I pointed out in these recent papers, that the revelators very precisely differentiate the word son from child. They do it in the regard of whether or not you're going to call someone a grandson of the father, the Paradise Father, or a grandchild of the Paradise Father. Those are two different things, because son is different than child. Universal Father, Eternal Son, Creator Son, that's father, son, grandson. That's son hierarchy. Child, I agree, is a different thing. There you've got pairs of parents. You have the Universal Father and the Eternal Son as one pair of parents. You have the Infinite Spirit and the Paradise Trinity as another pair of parents. They each give rise to children, Creator Sons and Creative Mother Spirits. And they give rise to grandchildren who are sitting in this room. Yeah. We are grandchildren of the Paradise Father, but not grandsons, in that direct son lineage, and that ties in with that whole bit about, whether or not you think of yourself when you're talking about the Supreme. Right now, you're not a son of the Supreme. Eventually, as a seven-stage spirit, you'll be a son of the Supreme Being, but right now, you're a child of the Universal Mother. You're a child of the She, of the Supreme, and one day you'll be a son of the He, of the Supreme Being. So that whole differentiation between mother, child, father, son, they're very precise in that language. They're trying to convey something. So notice, the difference. When they use son, when they use child, they're trying to give you a sense of there's a difference in relationship of you to the universe in some way that they're trying to foster, a recognition of. Okay. Meanwhile, back to the Master Seraphim.
Two, the Progress Angels. These seraphim are entrusted with the task of initiating the evolutionary progress of the successive social ages. They foster the development of the inherent progressive trend of evolutionary creatures. They labor incessantly to make things what they ought to be. The group now on duty is the second to be assigned to the planet.
Okay, just one little thing I'll throw in, because it caught my eye when they say, make things what they ought to be. We read that recently. Remember this?
High Commission.
With the conciliators?
Yeah.
So those conciliating commissions. The commission's decisions are placed on the planetary records and, if necessary, are put into effect by the divine executioner. His power is very great, and the range of his activities on an inhabited world is very wide. Divine executioners are masterful manipulators of that which is in the interests of that which ought to be. Okay. Never are words coincidental. Okay, the very fact that those words match up, and we're talking about the same sphere of activity, that gives you a little clue. So one, the divine executioner would be working intimately with the progress angels, the ought to be part. And that should really cause a little bit of a pause in what you were starting to run with when you were reading progress angels. I want progress angels to be fancy and flowery and flowing forward. I don't want a divine executioner to be tied to that. but notice that they did. So, again, you know, that should immediately remind you of what I've been emphasizing in this whole paper. This is really about the angels functioning in father-like mode, not mother-like mode. Even when you're talking about something as exciting and transformative as progress, there's some harsh facts that may be in play. In order for progress to occur, a divine executioner may have to make some sweeping, you know,
adjustments
to the material stage. You know, you can't go to the next act of the play unless you draw the curtain, rearrange, open the curtain again. Okay.
Wow, that's
different. Yeah. So they see that. Just notice kind of how, you know, how they were playing those together. Those who are fostering the next act of the play are these progress angels, but in terms of manipulators, manipulating that which is in the interests of that which ought to be, you know, like the right props.
Chris, where's that reference?
That's
paper
25. I think that is paper 25. Yeah, paper 25, section 3, when they're talking about the conciliators working on the worlds. Yep.
It uses the word inherent progressive trend of evolutionary creatures. That sounds like they're pointing at to be mind things that are real physically based kind of things that are unfolding, and maybe there's various concentration levels and locations and things like you were saying. Some of them need to be either rearranged, whacked, whatever.
Cleared out of the way.
To get the proper formula so that they can be moving forward. So that the divine executioner comes in with that kind of...
When she said that, and when she pointed out that inherent progressive trend, why is there an inherent progressive trend of evolutionary creatures? Is it because of mind? Does that have the potential? What has progressibility? Where did that potential?
Spirit.
Right, because we're engaged by spirit. Spirit has the potential of progressibility, which then the spirit dominates mind, that potential is actualized into mind as progressing mind, otherwise known as development. The only reason that there's progress is because we're engaged by spirit, because mind itself doesn't have that potential. It only has the potential of adaptability. It doesn't have the potential of progressibility.
I was thinking of you brought up the example of the stage and plays and acts of play. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to move on to the next act, but there's certain people that want to stay in the old act, and then they...
Or go back to five acts
and
prior.
And then because you're trying to move them off, they just want to... We own the stage, you know. And so...
Yeah, hence, you know, if you read the rest of that paragraph, you know, they point out that the divine executioner doing what I did read sometimes involves very curious actions, you know, that catch even those on high. It's like, well, okay, that was an interesting thing, but, you know, apparently he's got the authority to do that, and that was an okay thing to do. But, yeah, that's the way the rest of that paragraph reads.
Going back to what... John mentioned, I think there's a reason why they put these in succession. Angels and progressive angels. If you look at every generation has had a challenge. Mm-hmm. Okay, like John mentioned, our generation has had the sexual revolution. There's been certain political revolutions. There has been a whole change in mindset as far as government and the place of government. My father's generation, previous generation, was beset by such things as the Depression, Second World War. There were major changes made in the mindset of society at that time as to the proper place of a superpower like the United States as far as helping other countries. And the Marshall Plan was a complete, wholly different way of dealing with people. It was the first time
on a worldwide basis that a nation had exercised the teachings of Jesus Christ on a global scale, and it changed the world forever. Previous to that, my grandfather's generation dealt with the issues of settling the frontier in the second part of the Industrial Revolution. And prior to that, the development of nations and the development of settling the West and a continent and so forth. And I can't help but look at these two, and I look at the progressive angels. Well, these are, you know, they're kind of like a stage, but to me, they're more like steps. You know, you're going to a goal, and every generation has a responsibility of taking a step. And you can't take the next step using the same tools and the same solutions as you did the previous one. But somebody has to make the steps. Somebody has to say, this is the next step that we're going to make. This is the next set of problems that this society and this generation has to address. And these are the rewards that will come with it, but there's dangers and there's problems and there's issues. And the divine executioner say, yeah, we got to, you know, kind of crop back some of the problems so that they're manageable. So I see it as a step-by-step basis. And every generation is required to develop their own set of tools to address those problems that they're faced with. And the next set of problems are always different. And you can't use the same old tools to address the new problems that come along. Right. You have to think differently. And you have to do things differently. Because if you don't, your problems just get bigger and bigger. And you look at the next generation's problems, and you see things like global terrorism, a huge overhaul in the medical system as far as what are the ethics of cloning and stem cell research. What are you going to do when you are able to manipulate the genome of the human being and proteinase analysis and so forth? And beyond that, how do you deal with those problems? But every generation has a complete set of new problems, and they're required to have a complete new mindset. Right. And it lifts the generation up, and it lifts the society as a whole up.
And then that's, and that fact, you know, is the interplay between these first two, like you're saying, you know, that... you know, I am not capable of solving the next problems because I'm stuck in, you know, in the now to a high degree. There's, you know, to recognize that each of us is very limited, you know, that the future is not us. You know, the future is the next generation. If anything, I currently don't possess the mind that will be required for that generation because that mind hasn't evolved yet. I mean, on and on, just seeing yourself, you know, in a humble role, you know, in this bigger process. And you know, again, you know, that, you know, as we you know, pretty much deduced the affairs of each generation, what does that mean? Well, progress of the successive social ages. You know, these are, you know, that's what we're talking about, is not biologic in the family generations, but social generations. Again, it's mindful generations.
I think one of the great difficulties and one of the great challenges in trying to understand this particular section, and I agree with you, especially as you're going on and you're talking about it, I'm agreeing with you that this, there's some astounding thinking that we can do around this. One of the things that strikes me is, first of all, just how parochial we are in our view of seraphic planetary government. Okay, number one, we're limited to the human perspective, hence their presentation of seraphic, you know, trying to get us out of the mindset of our own thing. Then we're thinking government, and I think that was wonderful what you brought up there, the idea of, hey, there's a real link to the affairs of humanity here, and it's not just political. There's one division we're going to talk about that talks about political, but that business of planetary. We're so parochial in our view of planet and generation. You know what we think of our generation. We're talking about American generations and largely the ones that we're familiar with. You know, the way the generation looks in Burma or the way it looks in any number of other places that were not as closely tied to American development,
Yeah, just maybe one little thing, you know, remember how we've often pointed that out. That's the great problem with fostering generations on this planet, because it's not a narrow little bell curve of people like it is on a normal world. You know, it's this broad distribution. You know, there's a peak that is the generation, but wow, you've got to deal with these tails, you know, that are very exceptional.
Right. You know? So we're looking at, you know, a number of things. You know, they're using specific terms, and I think that's, again, wonderful, the way you hone in on specific terms. And they're using specific terms like epic and progress and, you know, religious guardians and whatnot. As we go on, we're going to, you know, talk about that. It really behooves us to really wonder, okay, what is the epic? Okay? Mm-hmm. And we haven't discussed it yet, and I'm sure you're about to get to it, but the idea of, okay, what's the significance of the fact that we're on our third group dealing with the epical angels, mm-hmm. and only the second group with regard to the progress angels, and you pay attention to each of those things, and you say, okay, well, so we're dealing with sub-epical phenomena, and that, I think there's another reason why the epic is put first. It's to get us thinking in those terms and saying, okay, what were the changes and how did they happen planet-wide? And what, you know, how do they look at this? How do they divide it up? How can we start thinking? They're trying to get us to start thinking like them.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, that's you know, as you've heard me say so many times. I mean, that this, you know, to reform your consciousness. This is a great example where you can jump into that whole process. You know, why not start here in really reforming how you see yourself? You know, to see yourself as someone who's never asked the question, well, what is this epic that I live in really about? So, what is it that I, you know, I'm really supposed to be about if I'm really going to be able to be a help and not a hindrance to what's happening on this world right now. I mean, there's always just me, you know, I can be my little me and I can progress and eventually I can start to fit in and get socialized on the constellation level and whatnot. But, you know, you could start some now, but you're only going to have success in that if you've begun to strike step with this bigger picture, you know, where you recognize that, you know, you're a satellite, you're not the sun. You know, it's not orbiting about you. You know, it's orbiting about things that are vastly beyond you. The whole epics of phenomena, you know, that you're some tiny little part in. Maybe, if you're not a parked car. Yeah. Yeah, one little thing.
Chris, yeah, I've looked at all the other angels. Course, and I didn't find anything about language on them. I would think that they would follow into
the nitty-gritty. Think about that. We'll get to that. There's a part that's kind of related to that.
Is there?
Yeah. Don't let me forget that. Let's do the next one here and see how these three fit together.
Three, the religious guardians. These are the angels of the churches, the earnest contenders for that which is and has been. They endeavor to maintain the ideals of that which has survived for the sake of safe transit of moral values from one epoch to another. They are the checkmates of the angels of progress, all the while seeking to translate from one generation to another the imperishable values of the old and passing forms into the new and therefore less stabilized patterns of thought and conduct. These angels do contend for spiritual forms, but they are not the source of ultra-sectarianism and meaningless controversial divisions of professed religionists. The core now functioning on Urantia is the fifth thus to serve.
Okay, so now these three together, there's many things in play. First of all, let's look at, just notice some of the things. Angels of the churches, you know, in quotes, wise in quotes. Well, here, you know, we've already seen in many places throughout the book where they point to the book of Revelation. And just in this section, we, you know, had, you know, a discussion about how the 24 counselors, you know, which are talked about at the beginning of the book of Revelation, how they fit into the real picture. You know, where's the reality behind that distorted, you know, record of the vision of the Apostle John. And here they do it again. They invoke the book of Revelation. You know, the book of Revelation starts out with these little passages for the seven churches. And there's seven angels of the churches. And so what they're trying to point out is that there's a truth behind that notion, and this is what it is. It's that you need someone who's focusing on conserving moral values. That's how the book of Revelation starts out. John is pointing out to those seven churches that there are some problems that are developing in each of those churches in terms of the conservation of moral values. Seven little vignettes about that beginning to slip, moral values being conserved. And so it's very appropriate, see, for them to invoke that reference, that these religious guardians, they are angels of the churches. They are the ones that are fostering that. Just like we read back in the religion papers, that's one of the primary, you know, purposes of religion in advancing civilization, in this full true science, true philosophy, true religion, you know, advancing civilization. They ensure that values that can't be lost are not lost. Okay? And so there's a group of angels that are fostering that. And and they're checkmates, the angels of progress. It's not just you can't turn progress into an ism. You know, make it the answer to everything. You can't create progressivism. That's false. There's progress, but as soon as it becomes progressivism, it's false. In the same way here, you need conservation, but as soon as it becomes conservatism, then it's false. You know, you have these three groups of angels, those that are focused on that which was and making sure it's brought forward into the future, that which is right now, and that which is coming up next, past, present, and future, these three groups of angels. You know, and definitely, you know, by using that word checkmate, you know, and they're trying to get us to start thinking about how we have sense of this. We have sense of conservation and sense of progress. But note how we want to turn them into a dichotomy. There is a check and balance to it, but not in a dichotomy sense. Just like it's not perfect and imperfect. You know, it's not a world of dichotomies. It's a world of dynamic tension. That is the universal absolute in which all this has come. You know, everything that we experience comes from that dynamic tension. You know, and so the progress angels and the angels of the churches, there's a dynamic tension there. But it's, you know, it's not about the past against the future. You know, the conservative angels are pointing to the future. Like I pointed out many times, there's three words that were coined by the Latins: preserve, observe, and conserve. Past, present, future. A true conservator is looking to the future. But, you know, he's making sure that the past doesn't get left behind. And so, right up front, see, they're giving you the past, present, futures. Just like we pointed out, and, you know, we want to go from legacy, tradition, convention to wisdom, insight, foresight as the past, present, future consciousness. And so, together, these three would be fostering that transformation, you know, so that, you know, the churches aren't about legacy, you know, and the current generation isn't about tradition, you know, and it isn't all about just, you know, solidifying conventions, you know, to hold us forevermore into the future, You know, a legacy tradition convention needs to be transformed into a dynamic phenomenon. And these three angels are trying to do that. Wisdom, insight, foresight.
So I was, I don't remember where, I was reading a bunch of old stuff from the early days of the Revelation. Mm-hmm. And I think I've got this right. But if I remember correctly, supposedly, the folklore says, it's definitely in what I read, that the angels of progress had the responsibility for the Revelation, and the day-to-day operations for the first 100 years was to the angels, well, the religious guardians,
the angels
of the churches, even though the over-control was the angels of progress. If I have it exactly technically correct on the management of this. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of that 100 years, and who knows whether it starts in 1935 or 1955, it was to pass completely to the angels of progress. Mm-hmm. What do you think that looks like in, if that is accurate, mm-hmm. if those early folklores are accurate, from the passing from the angels of churches, and let's assume for 1 minute that it's 1935, so that's only 25 years from now, that it would go in full to the angels of progress. What changes does that look like in your mind over the next 100 years from the passing of the torch?
Yeah, well, we know that the whole point is we're quivering on the very brink of needing to be an advancing civilization. That's about progress. You know, we're about being fundamentally a dynamic phenomenon. That's about progress. I mean, obviously, it rolls over into that. The question is, can we overcome the difficulties of the time that we live in, this difficult transition time, where we've had such a strong tendency to sever all the ties to the past, and we've thrown out countless babies with the bathwater, you know, and we have almost no form in which to pour the fifth epical revelation stably. Remember, progress and stability.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably the two words that preceded this you know, little recitation here. They have to work on trying to get civilization stabilized again, or the fifth epical revelation is going to make it worse rather than better. You know, if it's not stable first, you know, like everyone has talked about many times, there's countless things in here that could rip the fabric of, you know, of society apart even further. There's a lot of things that you could run off with false tangents on here and demagogue, you know, and disrupt with. We need to have some stability. We need to be seeing ourselves as making sure that we're not losing the moral values that are essential. Because with every progress towards greater liberty, you know, it has to be preceded by the assumption of more personal responsibility and more self-control, and the stability that provides.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can certainly envision how things might begin to take off in the not-too-distant future, you know, if those sorts of scenarios play out. But they're not going to be, they're the checkmates. They're not going to allow those progress angels to start running away with it. Well, this time, you know, regardless of the circumstances, let's go. You know, that's no check. They're not... They're checkmates. See, they're not even but checkmate.
Chris, would you please for a moment address the idea of form? Mm-hmm. Because what you're talking about is relevant in North America and South America, and maybe in the Muslim countries, maybe. But when you think about China, where there is no religion, and Russia, where there is almost no religion, and Europe, where there is almost no religion, what?
But there's forms. You know, in many cases, there's too rigid of forms. You know, there's primitive of forms.
Well, I don't know what they have in China or Russia's forms of religion, if they have any. They don't have much. Or Europe, it's kind of dead. So when you look at that Angels of Progress and the form that this might flow, do you have any thoughts on that in the world? And I'm not talking about over rapid extension of it. I'm just talking about the channel in which this will flow through.
We're going to come up on that. Let's just hold off for a second. I mean, one of the fundamental things is, you know, another group of angels is working on. What is the foundation for all human institutions? The forms in which this flows. The home. Family. That's the fundamental key. So let's hold that till we get to that group of angels.
Home seraphim.
Yes.
Number 9.
Okay. There's obviously, not only can we spend the whole study group on this one section, but we could spend many study groups on this one section.
Yeah. Chris, can you just speak quickly to maybe just one scenario that this could look like? Mm-hmm. I'll try and be brief. You know, we look at 1935, and we look at the evolution of the revelation, the history of Dr. Sadler coming out of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Okay, had it been the situation, in the first place, of looking at these angels, they are never functioning in a static environment. Their morality, so to speak, is not wooden. They are not cookie cutter. They don't do things, you know, except by looking at conditions and responding. It's very cause and effect. Okay? So they're not stuck in anything. But if they make a decision, they're making a decision because of conditions the way we find them. So here we are, we're on this planet, and there are a number of ways that things could go. Because they didn't go that way, we don't imagine them. But here's a scenario. Sadler was one of the most prominent members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Had the Seventh-day Adventist Church been ready for the reception of something like the Urantia Revelation, it could have been used as a vehicle for promulgating that. The same could be said of maybe the Baha'i faith, other things. Obviously, none of those things were. What has this last 70 years looked like? In general, you do not see institutions as whole institutions grabbing on to the Urantia Revelation and taking it whole hog and starting to promulgate it and preach it from the pulpit. Okay? That checkmate of the angels of the churches seems to be that this is not going to find its seat in the churches yet, or the mosques, or anywhere else. However, there's very interesting possibilities in some of these churches and the Baha'i faith. I mean, there's receptivity, Buddhist, all of that. So whether we look at it as 2030 or 2055, we might anticipate, based on that kind of apocrypha, that there's a possibility that there might be some relaxing of what appear to be evolutionary restrictions. There's nothing haphazard. I don't think there's anybody, slapping us down particularly, but we're clearly not ready, and they're not encouraging anything in that direction.
Yeah. And I would just suggest, just think about those two words again. I mean, they're not going to progress it until they've stabilized it. So we should be about seeing to the revelation stabilizes, and gets anchored into the culture, because they're not going to progress it until it's stabilized. To progress something that's not stabilized is rebellion. They're not going to be in rebellion. Okay, just real quick.
Before we leave this angels of the churches, I just wanted to mention that I see a lot of interfaith movement within churches I've been involved with. And I see this in the Parliament for World Religions. I think one of the most interesting things about the Parliament of World Religions, which meets every 5 years now and has maybe 8,000-9,000 people from all around the world participating, all different faiths and churches, etc. But one of the they've been trying to find out what is something basic that we can all believe in. And what they've come up with so far is the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. Doesn't that sound a little familiar?
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. And just, one other thing to notice that, so you again, You know, do you understand what angels of churches means? You know, like they try to point out at the end there. You're not talking about ultra-sectarianism and meaningless, you know, et cetera. But maintain the ideals, okay? What is a religion actually? It's a system of ideals, not a system of ideas. It's
supposed to be.
You know, and so to the extent to which a church is a system of ideas, these angels could care less about all that crap. Okay, they're not about conserving those ideas. They're about conserving the ideals that are being held there, as they should be. Science should be about a system of ideas, okay? Not religion. That's not, because if it's a system of ideals and it's not actually science, it's an ideology, right?
These are religious guardians. They're not angels of the church.
Right.
They're religious guardians.
Right.
And the church may change form.
Okay. So let's do the next one. Now, okay, so that's the first three. Now we change gears very dramatically.
Four, the angels of nation life. These are the angels of the trumpets, directors of the political performances of Urantia national life. The group now functioning in the overcontrol of international relations is the fourth corps to serve on the planet. It is particularly through the ministry of this seraphic division that the Most Highs rule in the kingdoms of men.
Okay. Now, this is the point. One of the most outstanding statements in the entire Revelation. Okay. Like I mentioned, you know, they've been pointing out lots about allusions to the book of Revelation. In the book of Revelation. And, of course, the Most High is ruling the kingdoms of men. You know, as we've been talking about, I mean, that's Daniel. Okay? So this is the point where it comes together. Just like 2,000 years of apocalyptic literature, you know, has fixated on Daniel and the book of Revelations and what those two mean together, here they do it. They bring Daniel and the book of Revelation together, and they do it in the most unbelievable way. These are the angels of the trumpets. Okay. That is a mind-boggling statement. Okay. And for those who aren't schooled in the book of Revelation, I've got to read a passage. You've got to understand what they've just said. You can't just go, oh, angels of the trumpets. No, they just said, These aren't, they didn't say, these are, you know, you can kind of think of them as sort of kind of like, you know, maybe a little bit, the angel. No, they say these are the angels of the trumpets. The image that invokes is the following. Starting in Revelation chapter 8, verse 6. Then the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to sound them. The first angel sounded his trumpet, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and it was hurled down upon the earth. A third of the earth was burned up. A third of the trees were burned up, and all the grass, green grass was burned up. The second angel sounded his trumpet, and something like a huge mountain, all ablaze, was thrown into the sea. A third of the sea turned into blood. A third of the living creatures in the sea died. And a third of the ships were destroyed. The reason it's only a fraction is because the rest of the whole is yet to come.
You've been having fun with this.
The third angel sounded his trumpet. And a great star blazing like a torch fell from the sky on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star was Wormwood, that is, bitterness. A third of the waters turned bitter, and many people died from the waters that had become bitter. The fourth angel sounded his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of them turned dark. A third of the day was without light, and also a third of the night. As I watched, I heard an eagle that was flying in midair call out in a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth because of the trumpet blasts about to be sounded by the other three angels." The fifth angel sounded his trumpet, and I saw a star that had fallen from the sky to the earth. The star was given the key to the shaft of the abyss. When he opened the abyss, smoke rose from it like smoke from a gigantic furnace. The sun and sky were darkened by the smoke from the abyss, and out of the smoke locusts came down upon the earth and were given power like that of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any plant or tree, but only those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were not given power to kill them, but only to torture them for 5 months. And the agony they suffered was like that of the sting of a scorpion when it strikes a man. During those days, men will seek death, but will not find it. They will long to die, but death will elude them. The locusts looked like horses prepared for battle. On their heads they wore something like crowns of gold, and their faces resembled human faces. Their hair was like woman's hair, and their teeth were like lion's teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the thundering of many horses and chariots rushing into battle. They had tails and stings like scorpions, and in their tails they had power to torment people for 5 months. They had as king over them the angel of the abyss, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek, Apollyon. And of course, we all know how they add to this. You know, they tell you, if you want to give a precise designation to who Abaddon is, you know, that's the chief of staff of Caligastia, who's here still. And Abaddon, you know, that's the personification of the root word there in Hebrew is destruction. You know, so it's the destroyer.
Comparable to Shiva in Hinduism.
The first woe is past. Two other woes are yet to come. The sixth angel sounded his trumpet, and I heard a voice coming from the horns of the golden altar that is before God. It said to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, "Release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates." And the four angels who had been kept ready for this very hour and day and month and year were released to kill a third of mankind. The number of mounted troops was 200 million. I heard their number. The horses and riders I saw in my vision looked like this. Their breastplates were fiery red, dark blue and yellow as sulfur. The heads of the horses resembled the heads of lions, and out of their mouths came fire, smoke, and sulfur. A third of mankind was killed by the three plagues of fire, smoke, and sulfur that came out of their mouths. The power of the horses was in their mouths and in their tails, for their tails were like snakes having heads with which they inflict injury. The rest of mankind that were not killed by these plagues still did not repent of the work of their hands. They did not stop worshiping demons and idols of gold, silver, bronze, stone, and wood, idols that cannot see or hear or walk. Nor did they repent of their murders, their magic arts, their sexual immorality, or their thefts. Okay, and the seventh angel, of course, invokes the whole rest of the story of Armageddon, okay, which I'm not going to read the whole rest. Okay, now, obviously, they can't be literally saying that that's going to happen, you know, with all of its magical, you know, folderol. But, I mean, what does that mean? Okay, to invoke, that's the image that they're invoking when they say that. It's the most mind-boggling statement. What does that imply? Now, you know, you've heard me say many times, I mean, you don't want to get cross purposes with the Most High, especially if he assumes regency. you know, and these are his angels, angels of the trumpets. It obviously could go very bad for a small group of people for a short period of time.
5 months.
Yeah, 5 months. No, like 5 months, for instance. I mean, I know, the point is not to, you know, to say that, Revelation is, is going to come true. The book of Revelation is coming. You know, we know, they tell you point blank, that it's gotten all muddled up with all that apocalyptic literature from 2,000 years ago. But there it stands.
I think it's a warning. I think, they're trying to say, you got to take some of the truth that's in the Bible, because, they use some of the words, and so they want us to look at that. They want us to look at the third group of the current dispensation, which is, happens to be 666, like I mentioned earlier. They want us to see how many, the progress angels, the second to be assigned on the planet. Okay, with the second, that would be after, I would think after the Lucifer Rebellion or something, maybe, and then the rest, now there's a second group that's on there. And they make mention to every single one. The religious guardians is the fifth thus to serve. So we're supposed to look at that. We're not just supposed to ignore anything that they're telling us.
I mean, I honestly don't know what I'm supposed to take away from that. But, just the one thing, to say this, the one thing. I mean, if it says nothing else, it's saying that no holds are barred. If the Most High assumes regency, he has absolute authority. So at the very least, they're certainly making sure that I don't think, but he couldn't, he'd only do little. No, they just invoke the angels of the trumpets and the full bore, the core of the book of Revelation. Okay. The heralds of the apocalypse. Okay.
Well, maybe this goes without saying, you're not going this far, but these are the angels of the trumpets, directors of the political performances of Urantia Nationali.
Right. Just
so
there's that part.
Those images, they're saying, you could just substitute movements of political forces on the planet.
Right. There's that, but remember, we're not, the point I'm trying to make is not so much the first part there, where they're just being the angels of nation life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay? In that regard, they're just like the previous three we've read. Mm-hmm. They're going to be working on tweaking the environment and getting angel coincidences to happen and, and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But it is particularly through the ministry of this seraphic division that the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men, and everything that they've invoked relative to that. I can remind everyone again of when Jesus told us, about the Most High. When he said, yes, nevertheless, I admonish you that these scribes and Pharisees still sit in Moses' seat. And therefore, until the Most Highs who rule in the kingdoms of men shall finally overthrow this nation and destroy the place of these rulers, I bid you cooperate with these elders of Israel. There's a very interesting thing that's, that runs underneath. It's carefully underneath, so it isn't so out front like it is in the book of Revelation. But it's there. Very solidly, firmly underneath, as you look through the Revelation, there's, in the conduct and destiny, the Father gets his way.
Okay?
Yeah. Yeah. Like we read last time. And it's just, we all need to recognize this. They're reminding us that, because this is a rebellion world, we have a lot of delusions about how we fit into things. It seems like, unbridled liberty, is the way of the universe. And that just isn't the case. And at some point, we shouldn't be surprised if maybe it gets clamped down a little bit. On a normal world, It's not, it's not anything goes, with the humans. And it's not going to be that way when you go to the mansion world. You know, we're not going to go to the mansion world and say, well, I don't like this form of government. I'm going to, be an anarchist and revolt. That's just not going to go well for you on the mansion worlds. They don't cater to that sort of stuff there, okay? Yeah. I'm going to burn down the Father's temple, on the mansion worlds. It's just not going to, it's not going to happen. And so, it's just very interesting to contemplate. What exactly does this imply? Did you have a thought there?
Yeah, I was just wondering about this. It's totally off what you've been talking about, but it seems like in the evolution of nation life, we go from family to extended family, clan, tribal, and then there needs to be movement from tribal to nationhood and from nationhood to worldwide and worldwide to cosmic.
I mean, a clan, tribe, nation, territorial state, remember, is the progression.
Right. Yeah. And so I was just wondering if these angels aren't, somewhat involved with that.
Yeah, definitely. Evolution. Yeah, and also, they're not the angels of tribal life. They're only working with actual nations. Peoples that have come together and formed a nation. If they're still in tribal mode, we know what takes care of people that are still back in clan and tribal mode. That's the four indispensables, the cattle prods of early progressing civilization: slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive. Those things are in play and prod that, But once it gets up to nation, the angels of nation life can step in and start to foster this and foster international things, and all that is, very positive.
And maybe the dissolution of national boundaries.
Well, I mean, again, if we're talking true nations, nation is not a geographic region. Nation is a people word. It's a group of people who have come together. Out of dissimilar tribal, which may be biologic and ethnic in root, but tribal, origins, and have come together under something higher, like one nation under God. Take every tribe and clan from the earth and put them all together in one place on the earth. What could possibly hold them together? Well, something greater than all the clans and tribes, God. You can form a nation under God. Where you and I can be citizens of that nation under God, even though we may be of vastly different, backgrounds in terms of racial stock and stuff.
Chris, did you look this up in the Old Testament? Because I'm just looking, and there are references to these same angels in the Old Testament. Did you look that up? Do you know those references? I'm having trouble linking on this.
Well, just, like I said, they're definitely those illusions, but it's just, it's so important to recognize. They're trying to point out where, like they do so often, where the Book of Revelation fits in. What points in it. It's not a coincidence that you have the angels of the churches in the previous one, and this is the angels of the trumpets. That's the two groups of angels in the Book of Revelation. Okay, and can we, as readers of the book, not get sucked into apocalyptic musings, like Christians have for 2,000 years, and yet take that statement as it is right there? Do we want to turn our eyes away? Do we want to find some, it's not really talking about that. That's too scary. It's talking about Revelation and Daniel. And it's saying, that there's something to consider there. There's a reality to consider there. That, what will it be like when Machaventa Melchizedek stands forth one day and says, "Hello, my name is Machaventa Melchizedek, and I'm the ruler of this world." How many will refuse that? Violently refuse that? Mm-hmm. Want to bomb the planetary headquarters? Nuke it. Okay? Do you think, you know, the Most High and whatnot are going to let, you know, the Master Physical Controllers are going to let someone nuke the, you know, the Mach Aventus planetary headquarters? No. Okay? And they're not going to be sticking daisies in gun barrels to do that. I mean, okay? This is going to be possibly pretty gritty stuff.
Well, Chris, that was the point I was getting to earlier, is that the way this stuff happens, I mean, your example that you brought up with the scribes and Pharisees, mm-hmm. I mean, what was the hand of the Most High? It was the Roman government.
And, right. And again, noticing it doesn't say until the Most High allow highs allow the Romans to destroy you.
Yeah.
It doesn't say that. It says until he destroys. Yeah, I mean, it's very direct, you know. And it's that other side that the spiritual consciousness doesn't want to deal with. But there are facts, and you know. Somehow or other, in order for us to get back towards normalcy, we've got a serious rebellion, you know, that's rooted on this planet. Unbridled liberty, liberty without license, is not going to sit down quietly.
Right.
And they're reminding us of that. At some point, there's going to have to be a reckoning with this fact. The rebellion will be adjudicated. Okay. And what does that imply?
Very interesting you bring this up, and I've been ever, you know, you bring up the Most High so often that mm-hmm. that you know, you get all of us thinking about it, and some of what has come up for me has been, okay, well, the Most High is a veranda deck, okay, and the Most High, this Most High is not like a hired gun and someone who is, you know, on his own. You know, he's not, he's in direct contact with the Most High's an indenture, and he's responding to that. And again, we need to remind ourselves as to what indenture is about. And it's about universe legislation. It's about
law. And if the lower executive branch falters, they step in and assume the executive role as well.
Right, but they do it in a universe of law.
Right.
Okay,
yep.
These are all laws. What we don't really understand is that these laws that they're enacting, and it's struck me this way, you know, are a lot like the law of gravity.
Right.
You know, that they enact a law, it may be something that comes up in mind, but it has the same force of law as the law of gravity.
Yeah.
And it's always dealing with the group. And when we're dealing with a group, we're dealing with, you know, the concept of our citizenship on this planet as it compares to universe citizenship. The dissonance that we have with our citizenship and universe citizenship is that tension. And they're always invoking a law that is going to work redound to the benefit of the majority to bring them closer into universe citizenship. So it's only affecting that. Very interesting to hear a third, okay? that large group that is not interested in moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because of universe law. You know, maybe to de-emphasize a little bit some of, you know, oh, woe is you,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I don't think we have to worry about that if we're on the right track.
You don't.
You know, but paying attention
Jesus
to that,
didn't say woe unto all you people of the earth. He said woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees.
Exactly. So I just bring that up because it's very interesting to consider that they enact a law and it changes things.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to, I mean, I want to, you know, we don't want to go too far on this.
Yeah.
But I want to just, you know, I want to start everyone, I want to have a conversation going in everyone's mind when we leave tonight. But just, let me just add one little thing to that to reinforce that. I'll read the rest of that paragraph that I read back there when we were talking about the divine executioner. Their work is sometimes carried out for the apparent welfare of the realm. You know, the realm is the planet. Apparent welfare. And sometimes their acts on the worlds of time and space are difficult of explanation. Though executing decrees in defiance of neither natural law nor the ordained usages of the realm, they do oft-times affect their strange doings and enforce the mandates of the conciliators in accordance with the higher laws of the system administration. See, so they're invoking what you're pointing out. I mean, there's a rule of law on high. The love is within the form of the law. Love is formless. Law is the form in which love is poured. You have to have law and love in equal measure. You know, you can't put a quart of love in a pint of law. You have to have a quart of law.
This is fascinating. It's fantastic. Thank you for bringing it up. And, you think about what that might really mean in a broad context. And so you think about Michael of Nevadon. He who's seen the Son, seen the Father, and the ways of Michael, ways of love and peace and goodness, and the rule of the universe, and the rule of law that operates in the universe that Michael runs. And then you think about the Most Highs, the rule of law that must operate. And these laws are laws that make peace and goodness and mercy and all of the attributes of the Universal Father and the Trinity operate in any world. So that, and the Angels of the Trumpets is very interesting, because just go back a small number of years and we've got a group of people in Germany that think that they can use weaponry and murder and prejudice to gain world dominance. And the end result of that track in national life was one of the gnashing of teeth. And the worst of the worst from that kind of conduct that did not follow the Father's path, Michael's path, the universal laws, they were violating, the Nazis were violating virtually every universal law that could have ever been imagined. And you go back historically in war, and many of the wars, most of the wars in the world have been perpetrated, and you go to World War I, you go to the Bismarck's war at the end of the 1800s, almost all the wars have been breaking of universal truths, universal laws, with one group trying to gain unfair power on another group through force and evil, instead of the slow evolutionary progress of goodness and love winning over the world. And that reference is absolutely brilliant, because the end of those shortcuts end in death and destruction without a doubt.
Right. We all know that, the master of the shortcut, Lucifer, didn't inaugurate light and life. He inaugurated the orgy of darkness and death. Okay, let's read some more so we don't go too late here.
5. The angels of the races. Those who work for the conservation of the evolutionary races of time, regardless of their political entanglements and religious groupings. On Urantia there are remnants of 9 human races which have commingled and combined into the people of modern times. These seraphim are closely associated with the ministry of the race commissioners, and the group now on Urantia is the original core assigned to the planet soon after the day of Pentecost.
Okay, don't belabor too much there, but notice the race commissioners, they're there again. Remember, we brought those up and went back and read about them so we knew who they were. And, of course, who is their advisory director? The Most High Observer. See, so these two groups have a really close connection to the Most High Observer. And it says that those race commissioners are very active. So, hence the Most High is very active in relationship to them. These two, like we were talking about, obviously have to play together. You know, if the Most High is going to let an angel blow a trumpet, before he does it, he needs to take into account, you know, the consequences for the races. You know, and so he needs to be working very closely with these two together.
I noticed in these sections, sometimes it talks about what group in relationship to the dispensation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it puts it in terms of on the planet. And here it relates to Pentecost.
Remember, Pentecost is a... not everything is exactly at one instant of time, but roughly at the time of Pentecost, you not only have the pouring out of the Spirit of Truth, but that's the planetary adjudication. Not the dispensational adjudication. That was, you know, a little bit prior. That was back on the day of resurrection. As you had the, you know, the dispensation was ended and the new one was begun. You know, but then as soon as Michael, you know, was a master son, he inaugurated the planetary government. You know, there was the planetary adjudication. All those various things that happened at that point were taken care of. And, you know, so that's, they're just, you know, so they aren't boilerplate about it. They use different expressions, but they're all essentially referring to the same thing. The difference between this dispensation and since the planetary adjudication, you know, since Pentecost, is just that tiny little bit of difference that makes no difference, you know, between the resurrection and Pentecost.
Doesn't sound like the attitude we normally bring to the text about how they use language.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to. I mean, you know, they do have some precision here. Sometimes they say, you know, like here, I guess it was right here, isn't it? Yeah, soon after the day of Pentecost. You know, so their point, you know, like I was saying, I mean, it's not like a magic time where instantly everything was set up. You know, but roughly at that point, and so they give you some little sense that, you know, that there was some time to get things set up and whatnot. But they do refer to that point as the planetary adjudication, so that, you know, it, in distinction to the dispensational adjudication. So you have to, you know, remember to keep those two separate.
Right. You know, you don't see anything about that would particularly relate to the races.
Right? I don't know. I mean, at this point, nothing's leaping out at me. But I'm probably missing many things. So,
who's the Ministry of Race Commissioners?
The Ministry of the Race. You know, there's these are spirit-fused mortals. Who are of the core of perfection. And so it's kind of interesting. You know, you've got the core of completion here, the seraphim, working with the spirit-fused mortals who are part of the core of perfection here in the race commissioners. You've got these two cores of perfection and completion working together here in this group. But they're spirit-fused mortals of long service and hence wisdom in the local universe, who are beginning their progress to becoming high commissioners, and they begin as race commissioners, serving on planets.
Connor?
Yep.
Both the angels of the trumpets of the nations and the comment on the races should be taken into context with the angels of progression. Mm-hmm. And the apocalyptic angels, because you're looking at social and physical problems of the planet that those angels are also going to become engaged in. You could look at the angels of the nations as a warning that you cannot tolerate foolishness when you get so much power within the nations. You cannot tolerate the inhuman treatment of millions of people by the hands of a few dictators. You cannot tolerate a global tolerance of a tiny nation inflicting thermonuclear warfare on another nation because of some dogmatism or whatever. And at the same time, when you look at the angels of race, you have to say, what is the objective of the diverse races? The objective of the planet is to have a single race that has the amalgamation, the best characteristics of each of the races. So you don't have some guy sitting out there, well, you know, how about the orange race? You know, we got to figure
out. But we talked about this last time. We talked about this last time, you know, that whole issue of what that means.
So in that context, you have how, let's bring it right down to what's happening now. In 15 years, they project one out of three people will have diabetes. What does that say as far as the amalgamation of the strongest elements of the races or of the of the genome? How do you deal with the problem and at the same time raise not only a strong culture, but strong individuals. I think what these angels are doing is not only moving the nation forward, but I really don't think God wants to raise weaklings or fools.
No.
And I think part of the lesson that these angels bring is the sense of responsibility, not only as a nation or as administrators of nations, but as individuals. So they're saying, you better think about what's going on, because bad things can happen if you don't. And if you don't, bad things surely will happen within the context of what we have.
So I
think what they're saying is, you know, take responsibility individually and as a group, and pay attention to the objectives that you need to move forward towards.
Yeah, and definitely, like we pointed out when we were talking about the race commissioners before, it's a lot like when we were talking up here about generations. You know, put Mindel first in your understanding before matter. And it's, you know, it's the strains of consciousness that a particular race has, you know, the relationship to the adjutants that they favor, that is important to the mix, that needs to be taken into account and, you know, and conserved as much as possible and brought into the mix, you know, regardless of whether or not there's been some blending in. You know, it might not have an orange man skin color anymore, but it's still a predominantly orange man consciousness. You know, that's the race that they're seeing, that Mindel race, you know, that is rooted back in the actual physical foundation, you know. All right. Angels.
6, the angels of the future. These are the projection angels who forecast a future age and plan for the realization of the better things of a new and advancing dispensation. They are the architects of the successive eras. The group now on the planet has thus functioned since the beginning of the current dispensation.
They don't have to rotate. They
don't have a future. we don't have a lot of time, obviously, to dwell on all these different numbers of how many rotations, but, you know, yeah, everyone, you know, noticed those. And yeah.
May I just make a suggestion that we finish this next week? Because we're just going to be rushing through here. I need a break. It's late.
I think that's a good suggestion because I don't want to skip and go too fast.
Okay, all right.
It's all very interesting.
Okay, we can do that. So let's you know, you notice we've got the first 6 here. And it's also, you notice that the descriptions on these other ones are smaller. But the consequences are, you know, nonetheless, great. But, you know, they obviously knew that what, you know, they had to say about these first ones was pretty radical stuff in a lot of ways. You know, they gave a couple more sentences to each, you know, and they put them up front. And so it's not surprising that we would have spent, you know, a lot of time on them. Go forward and spend a lot more time on your own thinking about just the ramifications of this. So let's just talk just a little bit more about this last little group then. How do you see the difference between the angels of the future and the progress angels? Anyone have a thought?
Future age. As a future age,
right,
as
right.
opposed to the progress angels, or maybe the next generation, or something like that.
Right.
You know?
Progress within the age.
Within the age, yeah. This is a future age, so I would think that for us, that would be the magisterial age.
Right. Yeah. Looking to the next dispensation, of the realization of the better things of a new and advancing dispensation, not age.
Quality.
See, but literally dispensation. Okay. So there's a group of angels, you know, when you've got the epical angels and the progress angels and the religious guardians working within, you know, this dispensation and the flow in it, you've got another group that are really devoted, okay, well, what are we flowing towards here? You know, let's not lose sight of the even bigger picture. You know, where this is going to next.
It makes sense why they haven't changed that, because we've been in one dispensation since the beginning.
Yeah. And You know, and they have, you know, they are the architects of the success of your earth. That's an interesting statement. Not just facilitators of things moving now towards then, but architects, pretty strong word.
You think they're getting mind forms ready for us?
I got the impression through all these that they, it just struck me as odd how much they think they're in charge of things. You know what I mean? Like,
they think the same about us.
but you know what I mean? Like, it's, it, we, I mean, we sort of think of our foibles as having so much consequence, but it, I mean, it sounds kind of like, you know, all the different characteristics of each generation are sort of master planned.
Yes.
From, you know, and you know, this new generation that the last generation thinks is a complete failure or whatever, you know, in any era is part of the plan from way back, you know.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, that ties into, you know, a point I've tried to help build in everyone's mind. It's a significant Reformation thought that they're trying to challenge you with. That, you know, you and I can manifest very little personality. Even if we are fully consecrated to it, we can manifest very little personality in this very limited vehicle that we have right now. Because this is matter. And personality is spirit pattern. I've got very little spirit that I can pattern. Period. No matter how wholeheartedly I work at it, okay? I can only go so far. And so because of that, an awful lot of this life is pretty mechanical. And we've talked about that a lot. They can project most of what you're going to do in your entire life from the moment of conception. They send that projection to Vennington, and then your thought adjusters volunteer again, and one is selected, you know, based on that projection. Shane is going to do blank, 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 blank. You know, and maybe if we're lucky, he'll actually do something real. But pretty much he's going to do blank, 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 and blank. You know, and all these angels know that. They've coordinated your life projection into this whole picture. You know, to see, you know, to see yourself as a tadpole, you know. Yeah, that's a big part of what's being said here.
I know, we got to go.
Yep.
I just had one final thought on these trumpet deals.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the trumpeters. Think about in the 20th century, we had Adolf Hitler, Mao, Joseph Stalin, and Jenner. Between those four people, the amount of murder, 130 million people murdered. And then you think about, from the angel's point of view, who would take charge to do everything they could to block the evil acts of Jinnah during the Pakistan-Indian conflict, or the 50 million or 60 million people that Stalin killed? Who fed Winston Churchill from the angelic corps to mobilize the world to strike back against Hitler? It makes total sense, those trumpets. That's a brilliant catch on your part. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Very illuminating. There had to be a corps there ready to fight, to defend national life from people that took the basics. What did they take away from people? What did Joseph Stalin take? He took the free will of the Soviet people completely away and put those people, 200 million, 250 million people in a virtual prison camp. But the Father in Heaven doesn't take the free will away from mortal man. The violation of universe law that Joseph Stalin did was unprecedented, and the angels couldn't stand by. So, thank you. That's mm-hmm. just wonderful.
Yeah,
makes great sense.
And just one thought, since next week we will be rolling over into the reservists, too.
What is your...
Go ahead. Okay, just keep in mind here, as we leave this last one behind, think of the destiny reservists, the core of destiny reservists that are assigned to this core of angels. Angels of the future. These are the projection angels who forecast the future age and plan for the realization of the better things of a new and advancing dispensation. They are the architects of the successive eras. Okay? There are reservists for them, trained. And possibly activated. Now, that's a fascinating group of your, you know, we can, you know, the, you know, we need a warrior, and so you, you know, you activate, you know, possibly Churchill, you know, as a reservist or something like that. But wow, I mean, there's an interesting group of reservists to contemplate. Someone who would be activated, who would step forth with a voice about the next dispensation. You know, what would that look like?
And what's interesting is you don't know that they're reservists.
Right. Right. They don't even know.
So
very encumbering.
So these angels are working with the reservist on the planet.
Every,
all these angels.
Every single corps of angels has a corps of reservists. There's 12
so
corps
there's
of reservists.
There's going to be some physical human that is,
yeah,
is
several.
Acting out. Yeah.
And not necessarily, you know, none of them may have been activated. You know, maybe none of these angels have activated any reservists,
right,
but they've got a core that they've trained extensively relative to the, you know, the truths of the next dispensation.
Yeah. And so these folks might be vocalizing that.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. So just always keep that in mind, you know, and especially that's a biggie, you know, that is a little more subtle as we read these next ones next time. The reservists that are tied to these,
right,
you know, and what would they look like if they were manifested? What would their voice sound like? You know, if one of these reservists was activated,
would they write a book of their own?
Or what? Yeah, what would they do? Yeah.
I've heard of some.
So anyway, all right. So we'll pick up on the rest of the crew next time, and then roll right into the reservists that go with them. So let's take a moment here.